This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us. We're here ready to discuss the important events of this past week with our panel of trumpet writers. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
We also have Anthony Chibaterwe.
Greetings.
And from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
A lot of people the world over are recognizing that this world is growing more dangerous, that the threat of a major war, even World War III, is quite serious. And one of those people is the president of Russia, who many would argue is pushing the world towards such a war. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah.
Yes, on Thursday, Russian President Vladimir Putin held his annual Direct Line television program. And this is a program that gives journalists and citizens from all over Russia the chance to call in or text in and ask Vladimir Putin a question. And one of the people asked him if he thinks a third world war will soon break out. And Putin's answer to this was really quite interesting. He started off by quoting Albert Einstein, actually one of my favorite Einstein quotes, which basically says, if World War III is to be fought with nuclear weapons, then World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones. And then from there, Putin said, quote, the realization that a third world war could bring the end of civilization should deter us from taking dangerous steps globally. So, as you said, that is a little bit ironic. You know, a lot of people would say that he's one of the main individuals pushing the world toward a third war, but he's saying this should deter us from taking steps, just to know that it could result in a kind of a fundamental reset or even extinguishing civilization. But Putin is acknowledging just how high the stakes are in this nuclear age and just how catastrophic a third world war would be. You know, just saying there that it would mark the end of civilization. And then from there, he went on to talk about how the period of relative peace that the world has experienced since the end of World War II is now being threatened. And of course, he says it's America that's threatening the peace, and definitely not him, and China and Iran and other revisionist and destabilizing powers. But nevertheless, it's clear that Putin is very mindful of just how fragile the peace now is and just how quickly it could all be destroyed.
This was at the same time there was a you drew attention to a new global peace index of this last year showing that the world is becoming less and less peaceful. Tell us about that.
Yes, the Global Peace Index of 2018 was published just in the last few days. And the authors and analysts who compiled this report seem to basically agree with Putin's view that current trends are threatening what little peace the world has. They say that the world today is less peaceful and less stable than it has been any time in the last decade. And this, the Global Peace Index measures three things. It's the level of societal safety, the ongoing domestic and international conflicts related to a given country, and the degree of militarization. And it measures these factors in somewhere around 160 countries around the world. And their findings for this year are pretty bleak. They show that in 92 of the countries that they studied, the conditions are deteriorating. So I think when you put this report next to that reminder from Putin, the man whose finger is on the button of the world's largest or second largest nuclear arsenal, depending on how you measure it, then it just shows how mankind's civilization and the peace that we have right now is far more fragile than we may think.
This statement from Putin, it is interesting. It was just this week that Russia actually tested a new hypersonic missile that has quite a few people concerned. I guess just looking at it from the standpoint of just how much he has contributed to that destability, tell us about that missile test.
Sure. Yes. This the test this week is not the first time they've tested one of their new hypersonic missiles. We spoke a little bit about it back in March when Putin first announced these new hypersonic missiles, but They're incredible weapons. Hypersonic missiles can travel at approximately 3,000 to 15,000 miles per hour. So that's about 1 to 5 miles per second. And just to put that in context, that is about 6 to 12 times as fast as modern cruise missiles. So it's incredibly fast. And on top of that, these hypersonic missiles are also maneuverable. And then the third factor is that they fly at fairly unusual altitudes, between just a few tens of miles and maybe about 80 miles high. So these three characteristics, their incredibly high speed, their maneuverability, and the unusual altitudes at which they fly, makes hypersonic missiles apparently unstoppable to even the best missile defense systems that the U.S. or anyone else has. And it means that right up until the last couple of minutes of flight, the exact target of these missiles is unpredictable. Mm. You don't really know where they're going to go because whoever's controlling them back in Moscow or Beijing can, you know, do a last minute little switch and there it is 50 miles off, you know, off from where it appeared to be headed. Mm. And of course they can carry nuclear warheads. So these have been called game changer weapons. And I really think that that is a very fitting label.
We also had an article up this week from you, Richard, about Angela Merkel preparing for the apocalypse. Could you bring us up to speed on that?
Yes. Yeah, so one of the Spiegel's commentators has been following Angela Merkel around for quite some time now. And he noted just this shift and this darkening of her recent speeches. He wrote that if you look at the world through her lens, the riders of the apocalypse are already appearing on the horizon. He wrote that she sees the pillars of the world order teetering everywhere. He wrote, if there's one thing Merkel cannot be accused of, it is sugarcoating reality. Listening to her is sometimes a rather frightening experience. He talked about how she's kind of reaching back to history to talk about this. She's talking a lot about the Peace of Augsburg, which was a settlement in 1555, was meant to end Europe's wars of religion. And about 60 years later, you had the 30 Years' War. To this day, one of the most destructive wars in Europe when it comes to population loss. You know, some parts of Germany lost 30%, some even 50% of their population in this war. So some pretty dark parallels that she's drawing there.
So this is the type of language really that we're hearing from more and more commentators and looking at the realities of what's happening in the world today. We even had an article on, I think it was yours, Richard, about citizens within, or the Swedish government preparing its people for war. We see this type of thing happening more and more. It is quite remarkable to see this. I'm thinking of the booklet that Gerald Fleury released just this past year, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door. When you look at the prophecies of the Bible, there you see that there really is significant reason for the concern that so many people are demonstrating today.
That's right. Yes, in Mr. Fleury's booklet, one of the points he makes in there is that the Bible actually discusses the nuclear age that we're living in. You know, it doesn't use the word nuclear anywhere, of course, but in Matthew 24, verses 21 and 22, Christ says there that just before his return, mankind will be engaged in a war so violent that if it weren't interrupted, it would wipe out all mankind. And so right up until the modern age, the nuclear weapons age, the technology to kill all people on Earth wasn't around. But now in a world where, you know, you've got thousands of nuclear warheads in Russia and the U.S. and China and India and Pakistan and the U.K. and France and Israel and now North Korea, too, now mankind very much has the tools to accomplish his own extermination. So it really helps us to date the Bible's prophecies about the end time and just to see that we are in the end time now. And one other big point that Mr. Fleury brings out, though, is that there's ultimately a lot of hope tied to all of this, because in that same passage, Christ says that before mankind can exterminate himself with all of those nuclear weapons, Jesus Christ will return and intervene and interrupt World War III, essentially, and usher in an age of peace. And Mr. Fleury, one quote about that, he says, quote, "Christ's return is at the very door. He really is coming back, and he will rule this world and show people through a great turning point in the history of man how to be successful and build a paradise on earth. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of hope that's tied to it. It's not just storm clouds. Right on the other side of those clouds is just a really bright future.
I do think that the average person, because we just don't tend to want to look at this kind of reality, is to bury our heads in the sand, to just focus on the distractions in the world around us rather than looking starkly at these things. The hope that you're talking about, really, for you to understand the depth of that hope, you do have to look at the realities. And it is interesting how those who are at the upper echelons in government positions, those who are really looking at these realities from a strategic standpoint and trying to safeguard their own nations against these threats, they're the ones that seem to be the most realistic about just how serious the threats are. So it's definitely something that we need to be attentive to and vigilant about. It's something that we cannot afford to ignore. I would encourage any listeners to go to thetrumpet.com and read that booklet. If you go to the literature tab, you can find that booklet. Nuclear Armageddon is at the door. It puts these headlines that we're seeing today in context. We have to recognize just how serious the threat really is, and Bible prophecy gives us that perspective. Well, thank you, Jeremiah. We're going to continue on this same theme, one of the nations flirting with nuclear potential and pushing the world toward war is Iran. The world has been trying to contain Iran's nuclear capability, but this nation is making threats that have people worried. For this story, we'll turn to Anthony Chavadaway.
The chief of Iran's nuclear program, on Tuesday, he was in Vienna, and Vienna is where there is the headquarters of the International Atomic Energy Agency, and it was there that he spoke to them and told them that Iran is planning to open a center for the production of new centrifuges at its nuclear facility at Natanz in the coming days. This essentially was a threat that he was making to the whole world, essentially. He's threatening to build more advanced centrifuges. But one interesting thing about this threat is that it may not appear as a threat because they are not building these centrifuges to completion just yet. They are building all the necessary components of these centrifuges because that's the only way they can do so and not break the nuclear deal. That's just another example to show just how bad the nuclear deal is. Under this nuclear deal, Iran is allowed to advance its nuclear centrifuges as long as it doesn't assemble them together. So that's what it's working on right now. It's making them ready for that time that it finally decides to go ahead and assemble those centrifuges and go ahead and reach uranium to levels that can be used to create a nuclear bomb. And when that happens, it's only a matter of months, if not weeks, for Iran to actually have enough uranium to build a bomb. And of course, that's disturbing, even though it's not breaking the letter of the nuclear deal. It is breaking the spirit of the nuclear deal, and it's getting a lot of people worried. Even countries that have been supporting the nuclear deal, they are getting a little worried. France is a good example. The French foreign minister said that, well, if Iran continues with its production of new centrifuges, well, that's flirting with the red line. So that's a very strong warning from France. We're still waiting for developments to see exactly how Iran is going to proceed with this. But just that announcement just made a lot of people worried. And again, it just shows how bad that nuclear deal is. And we have been writing about that. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerard Fleury, in his booklet, The King of the South, he said this: Iran changed nothing in its policies of aggression, subversion, and sponsoring terrorism. it didn't even say it would reform in any of these areas. Without giving in on anything, Iran was given all it needed in order to greatly accelerate its pace toward getting the nuclear bomb. This deal did not make the world safer. It was a disaster for the world. There is abundant evidence that diplomacy with a maniacal nation like Iran will never succeed. And announcements like these just proves how correct Mr. Fleury was in that warning. And it's something that the whole world needs to pay more attention to.
Yeah, that's quite bold of Iran, considering the kind of scrutiny that's on Iran right now after Donald Trump withdrew from that deal. And there's been a lot of discussion about what to do in light of America pulling out and what the future of that deal is for Iran to continue to demonstrate its intentions as boldly as it is. It just makes me think of that prophecy that's discussed in the King of the South booklet that you were talking about in Daniel 11, that says that this is a nation that has a really pushy foreign policy. It seems intent on pursuing its ambitions regardless of the kinds of consequences that it may face from other nations. As you said, we'll keep our eyes on that. And again, go to that booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door, to see just how dangerous this threat of nuclear proliferation is, especially at the hands of a nation like Iran, the largest terrorist-sponsoring nation in the world. Well, we appreciate that. Anthony, you're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. One story we've been tracking closely is Europe's response to these rising global threats. Based on biblical prophecy, we expect Europe to forge a unified military, and the barriers to such a project have been falling as the threats have been increasing. Europe's top leaders took another step in that direction this week, as we'll now hear from our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
So one of the big things we've been watching over the last year or so is French President Emmanuel Macron's efforts to reform the Eurozone. He had his election on a very pro-European platform. Right away, he put out his big program of this is how we want to change the Euro, the EU. He traveled to Germany and said, this is how we want to change the Euro. He basically kept saying, this is our program. Okay, Germany, how do you respond? And Germany, with all of its elections and everything like that, you know, there were crickets. And so he'd do it again. This is my big program. Germany, how do you respond? And there'd be nothing again from Germany. Finally, Angela Merkel over the last week or so has given the German response. In some ways, it's been very disappointing. She has absolutely not gotten on board with a lot of Emmanuel Macron's vision for the Eurozone, for these much more contentious areas like bank bailouts, common budgets, all of these things that would require Germany to put up money. What she has gotten on board with is the military. And even that, the way that this is the one thing that they can agree on, I think is really fascinating. You know, this is the area that there's scope for moving forwards. At the moment, Germany is not going to get behind a Eurozone vision that is on France's terms. It's got to be their way. So they're not on board with some of these big changes. Military, that's great. That's fine. And so in some ways, I think Macron will be quite disappointed with this response. But they have this agreement now where they want to push forward and make some changes on the military. So in terms of what these changes actually are, they're looking for Europe to step up this permanent structured cooperation that we've talked about on this show before that they've been working on. They want to come up with a European military intervention force with a budget. They want that put in place by 2020. And this is just part of the plan. Another part of Mr. Macron's plan is to trim down the European governance so it can make decisions more quickly. And Germany has got on board with part of that, supporting shrinking the European Commission from 28 individuals to 15, much more manageable size. So they're looking to have a European military that can be used, and then a decision-making structure that is much more streamlined so that they can actually use it as well.
What motivated Merkel to step out and to to give this endorsement at this stage, do you think? Is it linked to what you were talking about earlier about just her recognition of the threats that we're seeing in the world?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this article from Spiegel that we mentioned, it talked about how, you know, Angela Merkel sees the world as a very dangerous place, you know, apocalyptic terms, but she feels really constrained. You know, she feels like Germany needs major changes to face this, to just to live up to this world that we live in. And he talks about it. She talks about all these changes, and then almost in the same breath, but we can't do it for this reason, and we're held back by the German constitution here, and we need this, but I could never get it through the German parliament. Military cooperation is an area they can at least move forward on. And I think, you know, you look at what Germany has done, and they have moved forward quite a long way on military cooperation, just, you know, in the areas where they can. So rather than a big European project where they've stalled on, they've had trouble with that. So they said, okay, we're going to get together. We'll bring in whoever wants to come into the German army. So we've got now 2/3 of the Netherlands army are actually part of the German army. Huge portions of the Czech army, the Romanian army, part of the German army. So they want to make changes, and the military is one of the few areas where they think they can. And I think it was interesting from that Spiegel article, it was talking about how Angela Merkel, kind of on her return for China, really talked about how she actually had admired a lot of China, how fast they could move, how fast they could make big changes and big decisions, and was kind of complaining, well, you know, it takes Germany years and years and years, and we can't build an airport. They're building entire cities in that same time span. And so I think she is, if she wants to move forward, and she kind of sees this need for more of a strongman type leader to do that moving.
Well, that was an interesting point that you made in your article about Merkel preparing for the apocalypse, just how she seems to be coming around to this idea that there really does need to be sort of a Mr. Europe position, and she doesn't seem herself like willing to step into that type of role, or she doesn't feel like she's the one to do it. But to hear that kind of thinking coming from her is extraordinary.
It is. I mean, she's been talked about as the leader of the free world just because everyone is looking for Germany. And her response has kind of been, you know, she's dismissed that. She said, I'm not the leader of the free world. So I think she sees some of her own inadequacies there. And so, but it is interesting that she is trying to move forward where she can. And so you see the movement on Macron's military proposal. You do wonder, well, is this going to play into her decisions as to who succeeds her? Mm. Is she going to look around now and think, who is there that I can kind of get lined up to come after me that's a person for crises, that's a person for emergencies?
Yeah. So both Merkel and Macron are there in Quebec as the G7 summit meets starting today. And, you know, the lead up to this summit has been pretty interesting with the disagreements between the United States and Germany. Can you talk about that a little bit and maybe put this in context with what's happening with the relationship with the United States right now?
Yeah, lots of change. Quite a lot of people, even Emmanuel Macron to a certain extent, they're talking about this not as the G7, but as the G6 plus one.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like the G6 all against America, because it announced these big tariffs in the run-up to this. Even just in Germany over the last week, the new German ambassador, the American ambassador to Germany, sorry, he gave an interview in Breitbart, and he talked about how he wanted to empower right-wing groups across Europe, which is not a very ambassadorial thing to say, this neutral diplomat. The Social Democrats, the left wing, they're part of Germany's coalition. They're livid about this. They're saying, well, this is like a German ambassador going to Washington and say, well, we want to empower the Democrats. It's absolutely unacceptable. We want to send him packing. We want to send him home. I don't think Angela Merkel is going to do that. But it's just in this background of what we're talking about, trade ties last week and this kind of trade war almost that's building. Well, no, not almost. It is. There is a trade war built about there. America's put tariffs on Europe. Europe's about to put tariffs on America starting July 1st between these two blocks. So a dramatic fallout. So, you know, you see a whole number of these different prophecies that we're watching, big prophecies all coming together. Europe uniting, Europe militarizing, a lot of that happening in response to this divide between Europe and America, because if America's not going to protect Europe anymore, they're going to have to do it themselves. And so they're getting ready to foot that burden. on yesterday's Trumpet Daily Radio show, I went into this divide in a lot more detail. We've got an article I'm working on for the Trumpet print edition that goes through a lot of the detail behind this divide, because there are some very specific prophecies saying that Europe, or that America is going to draw close to Europe, draw close to these powers, and Europe is going to turn on them, that Europe is going to oppose America. And you can see the world very quickly moving in that direction. America has given a lot to Europe in the past, and now that is just divided, just like you would expect based on what the Bible has been saying.
I would suggest that anyone go and listen to that Trumpet Daily Radio show from yesterday with Richard hosting, describing that post-World War II period where America invested so much for the reconstruction of Germany, and how close that alliance was, and just how much recent events have been fracturing that alliance. Just what a dramatic contrast there is. Anything else that you would point people to for more information about this, Richard?
Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has an article, The Significance of Germany's Break from America. That was published in October 2014 in the wake of the spying scandal when America was caught spying on Germany. And this caused a huge rupture that we're still seeing echoes today between the two powers. And Mr. Flurry took that opportunity to have this article that really goes into depth through the different prophecies about this relationship, how they'll fall apart, what the Bible says about where this is leading. So that's a great place to get a really good overview of exactly what the Bible says and what the fallout is going to be from the split between Europe and America.
Yes, thank you for that, Richard. I'd also encourage people to keep your eye on thetrumpet.com and for this next edition of The Trumpet. It'll be out in a couple of weeks. That Richard is writing this article about the split between America and Europe. That is a major article that will be in that edition. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Over to America now. A landmark case regarding religious freedom was ruled on by the Supreme Court this week, and a lot of people are celebrating, but there were many big questions left unanswered by the decision. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, they finally have a ruling on the Masterpiece Cake case that was something that was widely considered to be a landmark ruling that kind of fizzled into what it actually determined. Just for some background, the Masterpiece Cake case was a ruling on an issue that happened a couple years ago against a Christian baker in Colorado. A homosexual couple had come to his bakery and asked to buy something, and he said fine. And they'd asked to buy a cake, and he was fine with that. They'd asked to buy a wedding cake. He was even fine with that. Then they specified that they wanted him to personally customize a pro-homosexual slogan on the wedding cake they wanted to buy. And since homosexual marriage is against the Christian religion, he declined to do that. He's like, I'll sell you the cake, but I can't put the slogan on it. So they took him to the Colorado Civil Rights Commission for discriminating against gay couples. I mean, his bakery had to close down. He was put like hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines and fought this. And it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And that's what people were really looking at this case, because the Colorado Civil Rights Act does say that you can't discriminate against homosexuals in a place of business, but the Constitution of the United States gives you freedom of religion. And so there's this like this legal clash between two laws that don't go together. And they're really curious to figure what's the Supreme Court going to rule on this? Is it going to be religious freedom law that wins the day, or is it going to be anti-discrimination law that wins the day? Ended up that Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote the majority consensus and dodged both questions with some skillful maneuvering, where he brought up the case that when this Christian baker was before the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, they were very denigrating towards his religion, saying that the fact that he wouldn't bake this cake for these Christian bakers and was using religious freedom to defend his decision was no different than people using religious freedom to defend slavery or religious freedom to defend the Holocaust.
Wow.
And so Justice Kennedy came in and said, "Is like, well, this man's been wronged by the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, who've attacked his religion. And so the ruling doesn't stand. We're going to overturn the ruling. He doesn't have to pay the fines. He gets his bakery back." But he basically ruled it on a due process clause. Like, if the Colorado Civil Rights Commission would have been polite to him when they were telling him that he has to close down or he has to pay all these fines, it would have still gone through. And so the court ruling turns out to be a big personal victory for the Christian baker, who now gets to reopen his business. But in terms of actually determining future policy in the United States, you still have, in the state of Colorado, you still have to bake wedding cakes with pro-homosexual slogans if someone walks into your bakery and asks you to do that. So there's no judicial precedent other than don't be rude to the Christians that you're forcing to bake baked goods against their will.
So it seemed like a real victory, but when you dig into it, it doesn't look like this really safeguards religious freedom much at all in the United States.
Not really much at all. It's basically a due process case that protects the particular Christian baker in this particular incident. There's 19 states where there are similar laws to Colorado that against discrimination against homosexuals, that where a Christian baker or a Christian wedding photographer or basically any Christian involved with something relating to weddings could be fined heavily for not participating in a homosexual wedding. Mm-hmm. And this case doesn't change that. And I bring this up for like the bigger prophetic significance in Matthew 24, when the disciples actually asked Jesus Christ for a sign of the end time, he gave them several signs. But one of them is that he said, "Take heed that no man deceive you, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many." And then a couple verses later he says, "Then they shall deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and you shall be hated in all nations for my name's sake." So he's Jesus Christ here is listing religious persecution as religious persecution in all nations as one of the signs of his coming. And now for the past more than 200 years, religious persecution has been routine in many areas of the world, but the United States has kind of been a unique example, or at least in the minority, in that having these protections for religious freedom. But since the United States is a nation, and this prophecy is talking about God's people being persecuted in all nations, we know that those religious freedoms eventually have to go away. And that verse is specifically in regards to God's true church, not necessarily every single Christian movement in the world. And so that persecution, it could come from other Christian groups, and it could come from the radical left. But you are seeing this movement building in society where things that were once taken for granted, that you wouldn't be forced to bake a wedding cake for a homosexual couple if you legitimately have religious disagreements with homosexual marriage, are things where the state is now gaining the power to force people to do things like that. And that is just a big sea change in American politics, and just really opening those floodgates for that type of religious persecution to happen in all nations, including the United States of America.
Yeah, the direction is certainly clear. It seems like, in spite of the occasional ruling like this that would suggest the opposite, it just seems to be somewhat of a steamroller in moving in the direction that you're describing there in the erosions of religious liberty. Well, thank you for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, Benjamin Netanyahu goes to Europe. Forces driving Russia and China together, a very politically incorrect statement about Nazism from a German leader, and Canada legalizing marijuana. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Tensions between Iran and Israel have been flaring up in recent months, even breaking out into direct conflict at times. Israel's prime minister is looking for support in defending against Iran, and one place he's seeking that is from Europe. To learn the significance of a recent trip he took there, we're going to go back to Anthony Chabadarway.
Just before Netanyahu toured Europe, he made it very clear what he was going to talk about. He said he had two very important topics to discuss, Iran and Iran. He started off in Germany, and he met with Chancellor Merkel on Monday, and then on Tuesday he was in France and met with Emmanuel Macron, and then on Wednesday he met with British Prime Minister Theresa May. So he was meeting with the most powerful leaders of Europe to try to establish a united front against Iran. And he started off talking about the nuclear deal and probably didn't go as well as he probably wanted, because Chancellor Merkel on Monday, she defended the Iran nuclear deal. But she did say that Germany and Israel agree on the need to prevent a nuclear-armed Iran, and that they had different views on how to achieve that goal. And in France, Macron blamed the United States for pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, but he also cautioned Israel and Iran both to reduce tensions in the region. And during that same visit, or on the same day of that visit in France, that's when Iran made those announcements about expanding its enrichment program. And that really worried the French. And the French minister came out and said that Iran was flirting with red lines. And in Britain, Theresa May said that the UK continues to believe in the Iran nuclear deal. So a lot of people, a lot of commentators have said that Iran, Netanyahu, is fighting a lost war. But Netanyahu was not just talking about the nuclear deal. In fact, he said that my focus for this visit was not about the Iran nuclear deal, but about reversing Iran's aggression in the region and getting them out of Syria. In fact, even before the tour, he did acknowledge that it's likely not going to be very easy to come up with an agreement about the nuclear deal, but he did express a lot more hope that they would be able to formulate an agreed policy on Syria. And it turns out that he was successful in that, because the Times of Israel reported that the leaders of France, Britain, and Germany had reached a general agreement regarding the removal of Iranian forces from Syria. So that's a pretty significant development right there, just having Israel reaching out to Europe and Europe actually willing to do something. And
that was after we had talked last week about Russia making a similar agreement with Israel.
Yes. And the article does indeed point to that and just said that Russia is supporting Israel, and now the Europeans are supporting Israel and wanting to remove Iranian influence from the region. And even Netanyahu, he did threaten that if Syria and Iran does attack Israel, they're going to respond. And it seems like they will have the backing and support of Europe. And that is significant, because the Bible does talk about Israel, which the Bible calls Judah, reaching out to Europe, reaching out for military support, military help from Europe to deal with some of its regional problems. And we're seeing the early stages of those relations forming. And we also know that the Bible does say that Syria is going to be more aligned toward Europe, and perhaps Europe jumping on board with Israel in this regard is another step toward that.
Yeah, very fascinating. And watching the relationship between Israel and Europe is one that we really have to keep our eyes on that. We actually, I think we have an article up on the website right now about the Israelis participating in their first ever military drills in Europe this coming week. It begins on June 15th. The title of that article, Israel Participates in Its First Military Drills in Europe. So watching the relationship build between Netanyahu and some of these European leaders is definitely something that we expect to increase in the time ahead. Gerald Fleury talks about that in his booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy. You can look at that booklet on thetrumpet.com. He describes the specific biblical prophecy that explains Judah. It foretells Judah actually going to Europe and the Germans especially, and it also talks about how that overture is going to end up. It's not what the Jews would hope for. So look at thetrumpet.com, watch for that booklet, Jerusalem and Prophecy, and check out that article about Israel participating in those drills in Europe. We appreciate that, Anthony. This weekend, while the G7 is meeting in Canada, the leaders of Russia and China, along with other Asian nations, are having their own summit in China. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this is the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. They're meeting in China there for their 18th summit. And so this includes the leaders of Russia and China, as you mentioned there, and also India, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. Those are all the full members. And the significance of this really is always Russia and China, though. This actually marks the 25th time that Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping have met in just the last 5 years. And there's more and more common ground between Russia and China all the time. And they use organizations like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization just to sort of help them work together more and work with other Asian nations to kind of expand that common ground more and more. And right now, with President Trump and the United States taking a firmer stance toward Russia and China, they seem to have even more impetus to cooperate and to continue to expand that common ground and probably to forge a full alliance. There was an article about this published by The Diplomat this week, and one part of that article says, quote, "Will the meeting between China and its former ally mark a new phase in the Sino-Russia relationship? Is China poised to abandon its non-alignment diplomacy, which has been a staple of its post-Mao foreign policy? Certainly, as tensions ratchet up between the two countries and a common rival, the United States, the scenario becomes more plausible." End quote. So, you know, in the last 15 years or so, we've already seen numerous major steps taken by Moscow and Beijing to lay aside their differences and to form a close partnership. And now President Trump and a kind of, revitalized America, at least temporarily, is giving them another big reason to deepen those ties even further. With China, besides the trade arguments that are getting more and more tense, there's the Taiwan question. You know, for China, that's a core interest, but the U.S. is approving major new arms sales to Taiwan. Washington also just passed the Taiwan Travel Act, which really validates Taiwan at a new diplomatic level. And then there's also the South China Sea issue, which, China claims the entire sea as its own. But the U.S. is increasingly sailing warships by those outposts that China set up there and just demonstrating to the world that the sea is still open territory. So all of that just infuriates China. And then Russia, of course, is also at loggerheads with the U.S. In Russia's case, it's over sanctions that Washington has placed on Russia and over tensions in the Middle East. So both Russia and China have really good reason to deepen their relationship so that they can kind of present a united front against America. And they've been doing everything they can, including having meetings like the one that they're engaged in now there in China, just to deepen their political relations, their economic relations, and their military relations.
This Diplomat article that you reference, it's interesting because it goes through all of the various points of how much these nations are uniting, and yet when it gets to the conclusion, it says basically well, we think that this is going to come short of a full alliance. And this is where having that prophetic perspective really is useful.
That's exactly right. Yes, this diplomat article, like a lot of geopolitical analysts, doesn't really believe that Russia and China will form a full alliance. You know, a lot of analysts say, yes, they both want to end this era of American dominance, but they both want to end it in a way that positions themselves as the other pole in the world, kind of. So a lot of onlookers don't believe that they'll form a full alliance. But Bible prophecy shows that Russia and China will soon be working very closely in a military bloc that Scripture calls the Kings of the East. That's in Revelation 16:12. And the Bible shows that these two, along with other Asian nations, will be operating basically as one massive, you know, unified military machine. So it does paint a picture of a unified Asian alliance. And we have an article called Why the Trumpet Watches Russia Allying with China. And it gives a good overview of all these scriptures and just what we can expect. And it shows that full alliance really does seem to be in the cards.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. Earlier, we were talking about the danger of World War III. Well, World War II was pretty terrible. The Holocaust, 60 to 70 million deaths. But according to a leader in Germany's second most popular political party, it wasn't necessarily all that bad. To learn about this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
World War II was pretty terrible. Yeah, that's got to be the understatement of the show. This leader, it's the co-leader for the Alternative for Deutschland, this new rising far-right party, Alexander Garland. He didn't really diminish World War II rather than talk about the rest of Germany's other history. He said that the Nazis are just basically bird poo. I won't use the language he does. In more than 1,000 years of successful German history, he says, we have a glorious history, and that, dear friends, lasted longer than those 12 years of Nazi rule.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically a very different interpretation of history. And it's one, I mean, there's been a lot of backlash, and a lot of backlash within Germany to what he said. And I think part of that's to do with the crudity of the way that he expressed himself and who he is, the co-leader for the Alternative for Deutschland. But you've had really even an intellectual movement making the same kind of points. That, I mean, yes, Germany has had some glorious history. I mean, pick a composer and probably the odds are that they spoke German as their native language. I think a vast majority of the famous ones did, but it's a complete mischaracterization of what German history is like. I wrote an article on this a few years back, The War Over World War I, just talking about how this push among more and more intellectuals to reframe German history so that World War II was an aberration, an exception, mm-hmm. not the most extreme example of an ongoing pattern.
Right.
That's the same kind of thing that Garland is tapping into. And you're seeing a lot of intellectuals where in the West, just about always you're taught that World War I was an accident. Until recently, in Germany, you were taught that Germany was responsible for World War I. And that's kind of, you know, that's a very key point in this portrayal of history. If World War I was an accident, then yeah, World War II looks much more like an exception. If Germany was to blame for that, well, then you've got a pattern. You know, Germany under Otto von Bismarck, it starts this war with Austria. It engineers a war with France. It goes into World War I. It goes into World War II. You're seeing a much more dangerous picture. And so you've got this war over history. What really stood out to me in writing that article was just how lightweight a lot of these exceptions or these books were that try to absolve Germany of any guilt for World War I. There was a German historian, Fritz Fischer. He wrote the book Grasping for World Power, The War Aims of Imperial Germany. It's available in English, and it just blows anything out of the water. Huge amounts of proof that Germany wanted World War I, planned for World War I, brought it about, were responsible for it. none of these books had anything like that quantity of proof or even dealt with that proof. A lot of them were actually very deceptive, you know, uttering these things that were very narrowly true but completely misleading.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got this much broader pattern to really change this picture of German history. And history is really important. We've got an article, top article on the front page on the website, talking about from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry, just on history that we can learn from American presidents. We're sounding warnings based on the Bible. You can get a lot of those warnings based on history. And so that's why this whole movement to just reinterpret history and reinterpret German history is so dangerous.
So what are you... I guess you're putting this in this larger context. We're talking about one indelicate statement from the leader of this party that a lot of people consider fairly extreme and that received quite a lot of backlash from among Germans. But you're viewing this basically as this is an example of this whitewashing of German history that we're seeing within Germany and trying to absolve themselves of the guilt of previous world wars and essentially setting the nation up to be more militaristic in a future conflict.
Absolutely, yes. And some of the biggest people fighting this are some German historians. There are several that are basically saying, look, we've got this pattern of history. Germany cannot be a leading military power in the future because of this history. There are several, a very high-profile German historian saying that. But this push, well, that has major implications for the present. If World War II is this 12-year exception, absolutely no problem having Germany as a major military power, Germany leading Europe. Go right ahead.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for that, Richard. We're talking to the someone who helped a lot in producing our booklet of the Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. That paints a lot of that history that Richard is talking about there. And you can check that out on thetrumpet.com and just learn more about the history that he's describing. We appreciate that, Richard. We are going to squeak in one last story here. We're going to have to make this pretty quick. This week, Canada became the second nation in the world after Uruguay to legalize marijuana. To learn about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, after Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's Liberal Party pledged to legalize the recreational use of marijuana in 2015, the upper chamber of Canada's Senate got around to voting yesterday and voted 56-30 in favor of new rules making marijuana legal. They still don't have an exact date as to when that's going to happen. They were originally hoping to have this be July 1st in time for Canada Day, but it looks like it'll probably be closer to the autumn that gets around to being the, like I said, the second country in the world and the first amongst the like those top first world nations to make the recreational use of marijuana legal throughout the country. It's kind of a symptom that the support for it's been building for three decades. I guess the number of marijuana users in Canada has doubled from like 6% to close to 12% since 1985, which means that more than over 1 in 10 Canadians do use the drug. Yeah, so this is something that we are definitely going to be seeing the effects of in the months and years ahead. It's been medically proven that marijuana does just sap ambition, saps motivation, turns people, to be put very bluntly, very lazy, which can have a devastating effect within families. But for a more detailed look at the social and medical ramifications of this, we'll have an article put in the show notes entitled Marijuana Legalization, What Are the Effects?
Okay, thanks for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to all the articles and the literature that we talked about on the program today. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chabotterway, and Richard Palmer.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Ninon de L'Enclos. That which is striking and beautiful is not always good, but that which is good is always beautiful. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.